All right, folks, thanks for listening in today. It's the Agriculture Show here at CKMS Radio 102.7, Radio Waterloo, and it's a wonderful day in May. It's May the 3rd, and just glad you took time to listen to us. Boy, it's sunny outside, but a little cool, and hopefully you've been able to get some gardening done and that sort of thing. And thanks for listening in. Today is another great show. We have guest Mr. Bruce Muirhead, and as you know, all our great guests here in the show bring along just a great collection of music. And so we'll play these during the show in between our segments. And I'm going to ask Bruce right off the bat some of these songs. Where did you, the Heptones and the song is, no, it's the Book of Rules and the name of the song is the Heptones. Where did you?
Sorry, it was the Heptones or the group. I reversed that.
Okay.
Very sorry about that.
No problem.
But the Heptones and the Book of Rules, I actually can't remember when I first came across that. I was interested in basically Jamaican music at that period of time, the late 1950s, early 1960s, the pre-reggae era. And the Heptones certainly fit into that as well, rock steady and ska. So I really, really liked the song, although I think that if you actually look the song up on Wikipedia, it's probably not the best. I think it was written by a Confederate general from the Civil War. But anyway, the Heptones have made I think they did make a pretty good hit of it back in the early 1960s.
Yeah. Are you still a concert goer by chance?
No. No, I never really went to concerts. In fact, I can't think of one that I ever went to. And life seems to go along too quickly to.
It does seem that way. I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yes, well, maybe as I get old. Well, I am old now, but as I get older, perhaps more time to do things like that. Yeah.
Stay. Hi, this is jazz musician, singer, and songwriter Tim Lewis. And you're listening to The Agricultural Show. The Agricultural Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The WFA represents the farmer producers in the Waterloo region. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the policy needs of society.
Let's get to know you. Bruce, do you call yourself a country kid by chance?
Yeah, I think I'd call myself a country kid. I never lived in the country. And I grew up in Ottawa, actually born in Montreal, but grew up in Ottawa. My father was a civil servant back in the days in the 50s and into the early 60s, and I guess into the 70s as well. So I lived in suburbia primarily, or in Ottawa, and then moved into suburbia. But the last place we moved was a suburban site in the countryside. So I knew farmers. I was always interested in farming for some reason or other. I knew farmers. I had a good friend whose father had died, so I helped on the farm, I would say, 60% of the time. They had milk cows as well, so I helped milking when I was in my teens and maybe early teens to late teens. And I worked on a farm eventually on my own in Alberta. It told me what I didn't want to do in a way. It was a pig farm. The fellow had about 400 sows, so it was fairly large in the context of the mid-1970s, the later 1970s when I went. And it was in a completely isolated place in Barrhead. It was close to Barrhead, Alberta. It was a little tiny crossroads called Meadowview. And the fellow I worked for had actually homesteaded the place in the late 1940s, and he used to go to Barrhead. It was maybe 25 kilometers away from Meadowview in a horse and buggy in the late 1940s. He'd come back from the war. He had been on the Western Front in the Second World War, you know. So he was he had been a pig farmer all his life. And it was a very interesting experience. As I say, told me what I didn't want to do. I stuck it out for 13 months. I'm not quite sure why I did it for 13 months. It took me probably another 13 months to get the smell off my body from the pigs. But it was a very, very interesting experience. And living in northwestern Alberta, northwest of Edmonton, you know, it was quite an experience, I think, in a really direct way. So I appreciated it. There were three of us on the farm. He and his wife and I came along, and it was, as I say, not something I'd recommend for everybody to do, but it was a very interesting experience for the period that it lasted. I went back to university after that, so I thought there has to be something easier to do than this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd get up at 5:30 in the morning. Yeah. He had about 400 head of cattle as well, and four sections of land. So it was a busy, busy time, winter and summer. And I do remember on his one of the sloughs froze over in about probably mid-October, which was the first time that had ever happened for me. So anyway, I had my skates with me, so it was the couple of minutes we head off in the middle of the day, I could go out and skate for a while on the pond.
Yeah. Other great songs here, Pete Seeger. Did you have this song in your personal collection as well? What did you learn in school today?
Yeah, it was I first heard that back in the 1960s again as well, and it was it is a protest song. You know, what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? Mm-hmm. I learned that wars aren't so bad. I learned of the great ones we have had. So, I mean, it goes on. There are several verses like that. And I think I was growing up in the 1960s. It was sort of my formative era, maybe the late 60s, early 70s. And those kinds of songs just stuck with me. There are a whole series of them, Tom Paxton, Arlo Guthrie, Pete Seeger, a whole series of really, really excellent songwriters and lyricists and music makers, I think, who are probably a little underappreciated these days.
Yeah, there's a whole generation there. It occurs to me people are dying because in our age group people are dying. And a lot of these artists that we remember... Yeah. are no longer with us, and hopefully there's a whole bunch of new ones come along.
Yeah, I hope.
Yeah.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Sobeck-Swant from RARE. This is Community Radio CKMS Radio Waterloo. We are live streaming on the FM band at 102.7 or on the Rogers Digital Network at 946 or on the internet at soundfm.ca. Community Radio broadcasts and promotes local news and entertainment through the spoken word and music. You are listening to The Agriculture Show. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The WFA represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the policy needs of society.
It is Canada's 150th anniversary, and what could be more Canadian than someone describing living on the prairies? Is that not a sight that everyone can kind of relate to?
Yeah, actually, and I'm working on another, speaking of the prairies, I am working on another project with a group of Norwegians, oddly enough, who are interested in financialization of land, and a Norwegian colleague and I, he's a good friend of mine at the Norwegian University for Science and Technology in Trondheim, we're looking at financialization of land in Saskatchewan. So we've been to Saskatchewan twice, just linking this with your prairies remark, and we've interviewed probably 30 farmers about, and also real estate agents and land equity presidents and vice presidents, and a couple of politicians as well. We spoke with the Minister of Agriculture. He just let us into his office in the legislative building in Regina, which is, I mean, I can't imagine that happening in Ontario or almost any other province. But he spent about an hour and a half with us. He hauled in a couple of his senior officials too, and it was a really, really interesting experience. So that was, I know my Norwegian colleague, we flew in from Toronto into Regina, and we were sitting together, and he looked out the window of the plane and said, there's no way we can compete with this. And of course, Norway has about 2% agricultural land or arable land,
right,
that they could use to grow foodstuffs on. They have other marginal land for cows and pigs and hen farms and that sort of thing. But and it's right, they can't compete with that. And the reason why we did the project, or doing the project, we're still working on it, of course, is the Norwegian government is interested in policy advice on how to deal with land financialization and increasing land costs in Norway as well. So we have, in that project, he and I, looking at Canada, we have other Norwegian colleagues, there's somebody from the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, a couple of countries in Europe as well. So it's a really, really interesting project on agricultural land and its increasing price right across primarily the industrialized world, but big chunks of the world.
Well, so it's a hot topic. All governments discuss whether how much foreign ownership or not of land can be, and this is part of that discussion, I would think.
Yeah. We in Saskatchewan, actually, they have very, very interesting rules about land ownership, that if you're a foreigner, you can't own any more than 10 hectares of land, which I think is really interesting, or 10 acres of land.
Yeah.
It's a very, very interesting concept. And in fact, they had a plebiscite or a referendum I guess, about almost 2 years ago now in the spring of 2015, and 80+% of the population of the province voted in favor of keeping a really restrictive land ownership policy.
Yeah.
And there were even farmers, large numbers of farmers voted, something like 62% of the respondents in the survey were farmers, and they voted overwhelmingly to keep land land ownership restrictions in place, which in a sense is, it's not cutting their own throats, of course, but mm-hmm. it is reducing the amount of money that they could get when they sell their farms. But they have, for them, of course, and I think for many farmers, farming isn't a job and it's not land you own, but rather it's a way of life. So, and I think that they absolutely, we discovered this when we interviewed the farmers too, they talked about it being a way of life, and they might not be making much money in X or Y year, but they were absolutely going to stay on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't seem to care if they got, you know, $20,000 an acre for land or $2,000 an acre for land. It was the concept
of connection. Yeah, yeah.
Just keeping the land, which is the, and passing it along to their kids if they possibly could, if their kids wanted it.
True.
Was the big idea.
Do you still have family up in Ottawa living up there?
Oh, yeah. I have my sister and my brother mm-hmm. live in the region. My, I think pretty much all of my in-laws, except for one who lives in Guelph as well, they're all still in Ottawa. So we make the trip fairly regularly, although I have to say I left the city in 1973 and it's changed an enormous amount since then.
Yeah. And those relatives out west, are they still, or are there anybody still out there that's connected with the Muirhead clan?
Oh, I don't have any out west. It's we're just going to do various projects, but there are Muirheads out there. My father did say that he had some sort of distant cousin some mm-hmm. years ago who had migrated or emigrated to Winnipeg, but anyway, we never hooked up with them at all.
Sometimes somebody will do that. It's a huge database out there. You can certainly trace out all kinds of interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, that's for sure.
So after out west like that, you came back and went back to the university at Ottawa.
Oh, I went to Queenside. Yeah,
and met your lovely wife. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, it was at Queens. Yeah, as I tell everybody, I was in an elite program. Of course, the 5-year program. It meant I really didn't complete or failed my first fourth year. So happily, back in those days, I think university was a bit more easygoing than it is now, and I was allowed to do a second fourth year, and it was in that second fourth year that I met my wife. So it, as my grandmother said, it's an ill wind that doesn't blow somebody some good. So I met her, and I think it made it all worthwhile then to, I should have, it was fated, I should have failed my first fourth year, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't have met her had I not done that. And then I went to U of T to do a master's and York University to do a PhD. I just followed her around. She was, she went to Osgoode Hall for law. So, and of course I was, I don't know, 23 or 24 at the mm-hmm. time. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. So I'd finished at Queen's with her. We graduated at the same time and she was accepted into Osgoode for the study of law. So I said, well, I'll just go along with you, apply to U of T in August of that year, again, much more easygoing system than it is now in the 70s, and got in, and then after that went to York. Again, she was there for another couple of years, so what was I going to do?
Yeah.
And in a way, things fell into place after that.
It's funny how life has a strange arc to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. It all worked out, I guess, in a way.
And children of your own now, by chance?
Yeah, we have two. They're actually both in, they're both at McMaster. They're both doing PhD programs.
Yeah.
One of them's finishing this month, actually. He's finished. He's in biomedical engineering. So we have our fingers crossed that mm-hmm. he'll get a job somewhere. If he can't get a job, I think nobody can get a job. And my other son's in a PhD program in McMaster in political science and international
relations. I hope
you'll
occasionally regale them with stories of your youth working on farms. And they need to roll their eyes and say, oh, Dad.
Yeah, well, my younger son's interested in that kind of thing. The older boy, he's more interested. He's ripped the insides of his house out while he's finishing his program. So anyway, he's more interested in renovations now than listening to anything
mm-hmm.
anybody can say. Again, YouTube is great for that because he looks at YouTube videos on how to hang toilets and all sorts of things.
I think we've all done that. I find myself, even stuff I should know, I just check on YouTube to make sure.
Yeah, that's right. the toilet's not going to fall off the wall the first time. He has a hanging toilet, so, you know, it's important that it stick on the wall.
I think that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, not end up on the floor somewhere.
CCR, that's been around for a long time. Who doesn't like CCR?
Right, exactly.
And this year's your choice is Proud Mary, just a classic, good old rock and roll tune.
Yep.
I'm Owen Roberts from the GMOs. You are listening to Community Radio, CKMS, Radio Waterloo. We are live streaming on the FM band at 102.7, or on the Rogers Digital Network at 946, or on the internet at soundfm.ca. Community Radio broadcasts and promotes local news and entertainment through the spoken word and music. You are listening to The Agriculture Show. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the policy needs of society.
So after lots of academia, and I can probably, I'd want to ask an expert, so what do you do?
Well, I'm a history professor at the University of Waterloo. I started out at Lakehead. I was there for 21 years, as I say, of hard time, but it was a great university to be at, small one, regional. Thunder Bay was a wonderful place to be as well. And then Waterloo offered me a job probably 11 years ago now. So we migrated south, which was great. Our kids were just at the stage when they were looking for something else to do. They couldn't have stayed in Thunder Bay because there aren't jobs. Basically, it's a different kind of situation. Certainly back in the whenever that was, the early 2000s, it was a completely different situation to the way it is now. So anyway, moved to Waterloo, live in Elmira now as well. And I was a history professor for a couple of years, just doing history at Waterloo, primarily Canadian history and international trade policy, political history, that kind of thing. And then I moved into administration. The dean of the day asked me if I'd like to be an associate dean for grad studies and research. I had no idea what being an associate dean meant or what the job was about, but it sounded like a good challenge, so I did, and I've stayed in administration since then, and I'm now an associate vice president for external research in the Office of Research, and still teach a history course as well at the university. So it's the administrative part. It's not so much the teaching part, but the administrative part is very, very time-consuming, as you can imagine. It's pretty much a full-time job.
Oh my goodness, yes. And people don't give enough credit to people in your capacity, because a lot of what happens nowadays requires good protocol, good procedures, completion of tasks. And I think bureaucrats and those persons entrusted with those occupations perform an extremely important task. So
yeah, well, thanks for saying that. I'm sure a number of my colleagues at the university would disagree with that. But anyway, it's that we're hindrances to progress rather than anything positive. But I agree, there are so many compliance regulations now handed down from on high from the tri-councils, you know, SHRC or NSERC or CIHR, where you have to meet X or Y policy, that you need more and more people to oversee it. If you don't have compliance people in place, you don't get funding. I mean, there are a whole series of issues that flow from that. So, yes, I think administration can be I find it very satisfying and fulfilling. Doing research as well. I have a research program on the go, and as I say, I teach a course too. So it's all, I very much enjoy all three elements of life at Waterloo, and it's a great university to be at, great people to work with. In the Office of Research as well, it's super competent organization. And this year we've done over $205 million of research as well, which is, we don't have a med school at Waterloo, of course, and all of our, they're called the U15, the big research-intensive universities in the country. This is my plug for Waterloo. All of our U15 partners have med schools, and if you want to get really big money, of course, medical research is the way to go, and we don't have one of those, yet still we've exceeded by a handy bit, I think, a number of our colleagues in the U15 system in terms of research dollars attracted. So I think it's a great university, and certainly a global one and an up-and-coming global one too.
All across Ontario, those towns that were able to get a university over the implementation of that thinking back in the early 70s.
Yeah, in the 60s,
All those towns, it's just been a godsend. It's just brought energy, it's brought the money, it's brought jobs to all up and down the length and breadth of Ontario.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And if you just look at Waterloo, the number of startups here is remarkable. And I think probably 90% or maybe more of those can be attributed to the university, the students who leave and they start their own companies. Yep. You know, certainly Mike Lazaridis and was big within RIM when it was RIM, and then BlackBerry. It fell upon hard times. But the spinoffs from BlackBerry and when RIM actually greatly downsized, I don't even know that the community experienced any significant adverse hardship. You had people leaving RIM and maybe going to BlackBerry, but then, you know, Christie Digital and Desire to Learn and Open Text, and there are 1,000 other startups in the community now that range from 2 people to 100 people. I think it's a really, really remarkable place, and the community is remarkable, and the university also, because of its the spin-off effects of what happens at Waterloo is also remarkable. There's just one other thing I have to say about that too, which is we have a different IP policy, that is intellectual property policy, than do other universities and most other universities in Canada. We're probably one of 2 or 3 in the country who have it where it's inventor-owned. So basically, if you're the inventor, the university doesn't take a share of anything that you invent. In most other universities, if you invent something, you know, say you invented a new kind of phone, in most other universities, the university would own it because it's made on university property using dollars or funding that the university oversees. So it's a university initiative. Whereas at Waterloo, the faculty member owns the IP. So we attract faculty members to Waterloo, I think, that wouldn't normally come to sort of a mid-sized Canadian university like the University of Waterloo is. And as a result of that, of course, we've grown far beyond a mid-sized Canadian university now to be a very significant international university. I think we're big in Silicon Valley and here in Canada, all over the world. We have graduates all over the world, and I think it's in part, at least, because of the people we've been able to attract as professors because of our IP policy.
Just to throw a little plug in for the agriculture, at a conference last week, the guest speaker was from U of W in geography, all about what she knew about phosphorus in waterways and how to fix that and where it's coming from.
Right.
And so, of course, things like Guelph, my old alma mater,
right,
would normally wear the hat of being for agriculture and farming, but there's significant, really interesting research having to do with our land resource and all those factors at U of W.
Yeah, I think we do a little bit of agricultural research. I should actually say Guelph is a great university as well. I have a number of colleagues who I speak with on a fairly regular basis there, and I think that they are to agriculture what University of Waterloo is to technology, you know, mm-hmm. and agriculture is so incredibly important in these days. And I know Guelph Waterloo received their Canada First Excellence Research Fund funds, and Guelph got one. They're very, very difficult to get. They're worth tens of millions of dollars, almost $100 million in Guelph's case, on precision agriculture. You know, so Guelph is they're not an easy thing to get at all, and I think it's a recognition there. The applications are sent out for international evaluation, so it's not somebody down the road evaluating this funding proposal, but rather they're international experts from country X or Y, and Guelph received one, and I think it's a reflection of how incredible Guelph is in the agricultural sphere. Waterloo has two of these as well, so again, gotten over a couple of different periods, but it's also a reflection of how I guess the local universities, Guelph and Waterloo, mm-hmm. are quite incredible in terms of the research projects that they pursue.
You have Desmond J. Decker, and the song is The Israelites.
Right. That's again, I'm not entirely sure when I came across that, but it's been many, many decades ago, and it was also Desmond Decker's a Jamaican singer from the early 1960s, pre-reggae. In fact, he sort of blends into reggae a bit later on. And I just really like the lyrics of the song, how he put it together. And it's stuck with me through decades. So I listen to it happily with YouTube.
Yes.
You can listen to absolutely anything you want anytime. So yeah. It's very easy to find these guys now.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Funny and fly.
Hi, this is Benita Wagler from Waterloo Region, and I'm in the studio with Jeff and Mike. You are listening to Community Radio CKMS Radio Waterloo. We are live streaming on the FM band at 102.7 or on the Rogers Digital Network at 946 or on the internet at soundfm.ca. Community Radio broadcasts and promotes local news and entertainment through the spoken word and music. You are listening to The Agriculture Show. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The WFA represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the policy needs of society.
So this has been a great segue, and as an astute host, I'll ask you, the next part of our show is, I'd like to ask our guests, what do you know about agriculture and what would you tell people on the street?
Oh, agriculture is, agriculture is the basis of our lives. I think even though people these days, I think, have no real sense of what it is to be a farmer. I heard that. I interviewed farmers, dairy farmers and egg farmers. Last year I had a sabbatical in Australia, New Zealand, and I've done some in the UK and also in the US. And one of the biggest complaints in particular with Australians, and I'm not quite sure why this is that urban people have no sense of what it is to be a farmer. And in fact, sometimes I have heard stories, I don't know if they're apocryphal or not, but I have heard stories about kindergarten kids, for example, when being told where an egg comes from, just thinks that's so gross that they can't imagine ever eating an egg again, sort of thing. So it's those kinds of events, I guess, which make me think that we need to have a lot more sensitivity to agricultural issues. And one of the biggest ones, of course, too, is that people should be sensitive to is that agriculture is a really iffy game. So one year, as you know, precisely, being a farmer yourself, yeah, one year you do okay, yep, the next true. 3 years you don't do well at all. You know, and we certainly see that in the dairy sector. I write quite a bit on the dairy sector and compare those countries that I just mentioned as well. In the dairy sector in Canada, it's very stable. It's pretty flat line. You know, people don't make lots of money, but they make enough money each year to continue on for the next year, because we have a model that's called supply management, where we match domestic demand with domestic supply. It's a highly regulated system, and basically we aren't subject to market forces in the same sense that, say, a wheat farmer might be, or dairy farmers in the U.S., well, maybe not so much the U.S., they're mm-hmm. fairly heavily subsidized, but dairy farmers, say, in New Zealand and Australia would be subject to market forces.
Yeah.
So our system, I think, really works well. And again, I think that consumers, for the most part, have no idea about what farmers go through on a year-to-year basis. And again, just looking at Australia and New Zealand, but Australia in particular, they deregulated their dairy industry in 2001. And I would say 80% or 75% of the farmers I spoke with said that they were the last generation of farmer on the land, yeah, because their kids would not be taking over the farm, and they wouldn't be taking over the farm because they couldn't make any money. Mm-hmm. You know, dairy is such a mug's game, in a sense. One dairy farmer, he milked 2,000 jerseys. It's a completely deregulated system in Australia, too. So there are no subsidies. There is no government involvement. Basically, it's the supermarkets, the two big chains, Coles and Woolworths in Australia, that regulate the industry. And they, of course, are interested in driving down the price of milk for consumers in order to get consumers into the store. So as a result of that policy, and it's been going on since 2013, farmers aren't making any money at all. So this big Jersey farmer that I was mentioning, 2,000 cows, said that he thought Australians would be starving in 20 years' time. I don't think that that's true. They are.
No, but it'll be a big change.
Yeah, I think his point is that they can't rely upon government. They need regulation because the industry is so unstable and it's chaotic. And he said not resilient at all, which of course is the opposite of how critics of supply management in Canada describe the Australian system. They say it's a wonderful system, but it's not wonderful. It's only wonderful for the supermarkets, which drive down the price of milk and eggs, to areas where farmers simply find it very, very difficult to come back the next year.
I've been following the discussion internationally as well, and I'm comforted by Prime Minister Trudeau's comment that, in general, all industrial countries subsidize agriculture. It's just about how you do it. And so even if our listeners thought that perhaps, oh, my goodness, this is an odd system, and why do we have it, in which most of the world thinks of, it's just a different way of subsidizing agriculture or maintaining it. It's a strategic issue, having agriculture.
Yeah.
You've got to have agriculture. And so it's just a different way of doing it.
Right. I agree. You know, when I talk about agriculture to people, I was invited to speak to two American dairy organizations in January, one in Springfield, Missouri, and the other in, oddly enough, in Wisconsin, where a lot of the angst has come from recently, I guess, about Canadian dairy and American ultra-filtered milk and various other issues. But it is comforting to the fact that Trudeau did say that everybody subsidizes agriculture,
yep.
And I have no problem with subsidies at all. The Americans can subsidize as much as they want. In fact, farmers can't continue on from year to year without help. You know, it's when you look at dairy, when a cow freshens, how much milk she gives, there are all sorts of what the weather's like, whether you have flooding, whether you have drought, you know, what the price of feed is. All of those things are so far outside the boundaries of farmer responsibility, in a sense, and sort of farmer control, that they absolutely need help. And if we want milk, and if we want eggs, and we want bread and everything else in the mm-hmm. supermarkets, then they have to be supported. My only concern or my irritation with the Americans and subsidies is that they heavily subsidize their agricultural sector. And in the latest farm bill, which was passed in February of 2014, it promised $1 trillion worth of subsidies. And that wasn't even the entire subsidy bill for the United States. They subsidized dairy and eggs and all sorts of every single commodity, peanuts, cotton, sugar, they're all heavily subsidized by the state. And I have read statistics that say about 40% of every single farmer's income comes from the public sector mm-hmm. in the United States. I think that's okay. If you want an agricultural sector, you have to do something to help them. As I say, my only issue with that is when they complain about our system of supply management in Canada and say we have to get rid of it. Well, if we're going to have to get rid of that, then they're going to have to get rid of all their subsidy programs, which, of course, they never will do. So it's enormously hypocritical of them, it seems to me, of the American government to demand that we fundamentally change our dairy and egg and poultry marketing arrangements in order to allow them access to our market while they continue along with subsidies. And I think that you can go online and look at Google Images and just put in U.S. agricultural subsidies. There are a million pictures that come up about, you know, bales wrapped in dollar bills and that. I mean, it's a common meme, I think, in the world. So, and Americans, I think American farmers basically, although they're on hard times, dairy farmers are certainly experiencing very hard times now. I think American farmers never met a subsidy they didn't like. So, anyway,
you have all the good slogans. I'm just thinking out loud here. It's really kind of really cool, interesting that a history professor, born and raised in, living in Waterloo, born and raised in Ottawa, has become a spokesperson for agricultural stuff. It's quite unique, and there's very few people would have your capacity to speak about the issue, and it's so fortunate. We're so lucky in the Waterloo region to have people like yourself living here. My goodness.
Well, you're too kind. I don't know. Anyway, thank you very much for that. But I really enjoy what I do. I have to say it's not a job for me at all. It's sort of like an avocation. Following retirement, I'll certainly continue researching and writing. And as I mentioned before, we went on the air. I have a postdoc, who Jody Nurse Gupta. She graduated from the history program at the University of Guelph last year, and she and I are now working together. And I have to say, she's revived my interest in writing another book. So we're actually, having a young person around, I think, when you're my age, is really, it's great in
yes.
so many ways.
Yeah.
And we're in the process of writing a book on Canadian agricultural models, in particular with dairy and eggs, and I've been to archives, and she's been to a number of archives around the world as well. So, you know, it's like reading other people's mail. So having, we hope, anyway, that the book will be ready for publication 2018 now, or maybe early 2019. But it's, as I say, it's a it's great to be able to contribute to the literature, I guess, and maybe the discussion with historically based analysis of why we are where we are today. Mm-hmm. We live in a really ahistorical age, of course, and most people think the way we are today is the way it's always been. But mm-hmm. of course, there is a context to supply management as well, in dairy and eggs, and of course that was that farmers in the 1950s were basically going out of business at a great rate. I've read many of the letters that they wrote. There was a Royal Commission on Milk struck by the Ontario government in the early 1960s, led by J.P. Hennessy, and they traveled the province. And to describe to students today what Ontario was like in 1961, there's absolutely, it might as well be the medieval era, you know? It's mm-hmm. Right. So different from how they experience life today. Some of the letters were written in crayon as well, that the farmers wrote or printed to the commissioner, and they're just heartrending, you know, about how the dairies would turn them back. They deliver their milk cans to the dairy, and the dairy would say, "Oh, I don't need it today, mm-hmm. so just get rid of it." What's the farmer supposed to do? He's got, you know, 100 gallons of milk there that he's milked that morning, brought it to the dairy, and the dairy says, "No, don't want it." Or the contracts would change sort of mid-transport. You know, that the farmer would be responsible for the transportation costs and not the dairy. They'd have rust on their cans, the milk cans, and the dairy would say, "Oh, we don't want that milk, we'll get it." Anyway, there was absolutely no sense that this was any sort of equitable relationship. And I think that's part of the reason why we begin to move towards supply management, which actually gives farmers a role in the setting of price. And the other part of this, too, is that, an ahistorical age, so people have no sense what it was like back in the 60s with the federal government doling out subsidies to various farmers. And I read cabinet minutes from Donald Fleming, was the Minister of Finance of the day, and John Diefenbaker's government. In the 1961, probably 18 months from 1960 into early 1962, these guys are discussing in cabinet about the rate of subsidy growth. And at one point they said, you know, we have to pay $55 million this year based on legislation to dairy farmers. We can't. That blows such a great hole in the budget that we simply can't afford it. So their point was, we need a different kind of arrangement to support dairy farmers. And I think it's from that point on that they begin to think about supply management or some way that didn't involve the public purse. And of course, in supply management, the consumer pays the full cost of production. So there's no subsidy at all, no public money changes hands directly from the government to producers on this. And I think everybody is much, much better off as a result of this. And it's a much more stable system, mm-hmm. say, than exists in the U.S., where subsidies make up such a huge percentage of farmer income.
I'd be love to sit down and talk with you more about the history. That's always the part that, for a lot of people, that puts the framework in place of why things are the way they are. And that's a wonderful topic.
Yeah, I should say I mentioned how students today have no sense of what it was like in Ontario when I was a kid. And I should just mention, you know, no cell phones, no internet, no real 6 or 12 or 50 or 18 lane highway sort of thing. Toronto was a relatively small city by comparison with the other big cities in the world. Ottawa, where I grew up, was, it might have been 120,000 or maybe 200,000 people by the mid-60s.
Sure.
They still used temporary buildings that they'd put up during the war for government workers. So it's a completely different kind of context in which I was sort of formed, you know, and agriculture developed when I was a kid. And nowadays it's also people had a much closer connection to the farm back in the 60s. And again, I heard this over and over and over in Australia, where they would say 3 generations ago, everybody had somebody who was on the farm mm-hmm. in Australia. And now nobody has anybody, or very, very few people. You know, you have Melbourne that's 8 million people, Sydney that's 6 million people, Brisbane is 4 million people. So we live in urban societies to the detriment, I think, of farm life, because mm-hmm. people expect farmers to be able to continually produce their commodities at, I don't know, a rate that doesn't necessarily leave them with a living wage, mm-hmm. you know. And this is something I've never understood
right.
as well, which is why consumers seem to think that farmers alone, of almost anybody, should not be making a living wage. Who would work for nothing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it boggles my mind that this is what happens over and over and over, and yet consumers You know, if food prices go up for whatever reason, consumers do complain, maybe legitimately so as well. But again, supermarket margins in Canada are so slight that it's not the supermarkets that are skimming huge amounts of money off. In Australia, I think that the supermarkets, their margins are much, much larger, and they do pretty well in the system. But in Canada, you know, the supermarkets are, they get 1%, maybe 1.5% margins. That's pretty good for them. So food is just, it's expensive to produce, you know.
So, I mean, the good news is the public, most of the public is interested in agriculture, but they're being swamped by all kinds of other stories.
Yeah.
So that's a good deal. And, you know, what's wrong with professional farmers nowadays? Public relations is part of your job. It should be part of your job description.
Actually, I couldn't agree more with that. And I have spoken with various Canadian farm groups, and that's one of the points I make, that you have to get involved with consumers, you know, that you have to tell them what you do. And if possible, I realize there are biosecurity measures in place now on farms all over. We have avian influenza. You have high path avian influenza as well. You have bacteria that can go into cow barns, various things. So it's more difficult maybe than it was 50 years ago to bring people on farms. But I know some egg farmers who do that. They open up their barns and they say to anybody, bring your camera. You know, you can take any photograph of the inside of my barn that you want. So again, there's this idea too about housing systems, you know, which in eggs in particular. I think that hens probably, in a sense, have never had it so good. As the, I mean, if you're a hen, I suppose it's never a great thing to be to be one of those. You know, you're in a barn for 16 months and you lay whatever 305 eggs a year, and then you sort of end up as Campbell's soup in a way. But that does allow us to offer consumers, farmers, to offer consumers eggs at a really reasonable price. Mm-hmm. And the average Canadian in after-tax dollars spends among the lowest percentages of that income on food in the world. It's about 10% in Canada of after-tax income. And the United States is a bit lower than us, but there really aren't, maybe the UK, but there really aren't any other countries in the world that have it as well as good as we do in terms of the percent of income we spend on food. Mm. I know, say, 25 years ago or 30 years ago in 1980 or the 70s, my parents would have spent about 25% of their after-tax income on food.
Yeah.
So food prices have come down absolutely dramatically, and I've stayed low for a long, long time. And, of course, that does have a spillover effect on farmers. You know, they're the ones who are producing it, and they can't necessarily produce it as cheaply as consumers want to buy it, so...
And we're probably lucky in this country. Waterloo region is a good example. You can buy food in any configuration you want. If words like organic or free range, there's something for everybody out there at price levels, and that is another way for that new group of farmers to make a living as well. It doesn't mean one's wrong. If you're a farmer, you can make a living, put your kids through school, whatever it is you do, we love you.
Yeah.
And so it's okay if you want to be organic or you want to be whatever, that's fine. That's our federation, which sponsored this show, likes all. If you call yourself a farmer, that's good.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. But again, if you're going to be an organic farmer, it is much more expensive to be an organic farmer than it is to be a conventional farmer, for sure.
It's sure.
And again, just looking at, you know, where what I know best, which is dairy, basically, and eggs, and I realize that the Ontario Federation of Agriculture covers all areas of this. But say in eggs, if you want organic eggs, organic free-range eggs, there are all sorts of things those farmers do. In Ontario, we have farmers getting into this as well in a fairly significant way. I spoke with one egg farmer who's recently gone free-range, and I think she's organic as well. They had a 12% mortality rate on their farm in the first flock of hens that they put through the egg laying. So the normal mortality rate's about 0.5%. So if you have a 12% mortality rate, there's absolutely no way you can make money on that flock. You know, you paid quota for it, which you aren't getting the eggs from the hens because it's they're basically dead. So it's just a much, much more difficult arrangement. Organic free range is probably the toughest of all. And again, when the hens are on the ground, I did have some egg farmers in Australia tell me that we've gone back to the 1950s. When you put them in conventional cages, basically you got them up off the ground and away from disease and manure and various other things like that. And they were telling me, these farmers in Australia, that we've gone back to the 1950s with free range, where, of course, they're back on the ground. But when they're on the ground, they're much more susceptible to disease. Feather pecking is a much more significant issue, I think, because if you have a flock of 70,000 birds that's running around a pasture, and they are territorial,
right,
and they're used to having, they have a social group, you know, and the phrase, there's a pecking order, comes from that sort of thing. And if the hens don't know each other, then it becomes a very adversarial kind of situation.
Yeah, they spend
situation.
All their time trying to determine.
Yeah, trying to assert themselves or trying to do the other hen in, basically. So it's, you know, it's very, very difficult. You need more antibiotics for hens that are on the ground, all sorts of associated issues.
Those guys who are attempting to do that, then in a way, I got a mile of respect for the enormity of their task. But,
yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a work in progress pretty much all over the industrialized world, sort of free range organic. So it'll take some time to pick up the necessary lessons, I think, in large number, but certainly farmers are adapting to it, and that's what consumers want, and as they tell me, that's what consumers want. They're prepared to do the utmost to give it to them.
And Dr. Hook, great, great band.
Yeah, probably my wife will say, why on earth did you put him in there, but or that band in there? But anyway, I like Wild Colonial Boy. I listen to it when she's not in the room the odd time. So, of course, it's all about Ireland and matching it with Australia. So two favorite places of mine.
There was a wild colonial boy, Jack Doolin was his name. A poor but honest parents, he was born near Castlemaine. He was his father's only son and his mother's pride and joy. So dearly did his parents love their wild colonial boy. Barely 16 years of age, he first began to roam and found Australia's sunny shores and called it his true home. He robbed the wealthy squatters, their assets to destroy, a terror to the rich ones was the wild colonial boy. Back in 1861 began his wild career, with a head that knew no danger and a heart that held no fear. He held the mudgy mail coach up and he shot Judge McAvoy. A curse to every copper was the wild colonial boy. Jackie rode along, listening to the kookaburras' pleasant laughing song. He spied three mounted troopers, Kelly, Davis, and Fitzroy, with a warrant for the capture of the wild colonial boy. Surrender now, Jack Doolin, for you see we're 3-1. Surrender now in the Queen's high name, or your living days are done. Jack drew two pistols from his belt and he waved them proud and high.
not surrender quite the wild colonial boy. Jack fired once at Kelly, brought him to the ground, then turning round from Davis' gun, received his mortal wound. A bullet pierced his proud young heart from the pistol of Fitzroy. And that's the way they captured him, the wild colonial boy. Yes, that's the way they captured him, the wild colonial boy.
Would you have a moment to do our little promo there by chance, Bruce?
Sure.
Let's take a little break and get this guy done, and we'll get back and talk some more.
We are live streaming on the FM band at 102.7.
No, do the first part. Do the whole works.
Oh, the whole thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I see. Hi. This is Bruce Muirhead from the University of Waterloo and agricultural historian. We're live streaming on the FM band at 102.7 CKMS Radio Waterloo, on the Rogers Digital Network at 946, and on the internet at radiowaterloo.ca. Catch podcasts of past shows and visit our supporters page at radiowaterloo.ca. Community radio broadcasts and promotes local news and entertainment through the spoken word and music. You're listening to The Agriculture Show. The Agriculture Show is supported by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Agriculture Show is made possible by community radio. The WFA represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the policy needs of society.
That's perfect. And you'll be online for some time. I appreciate you doing that.
And my pleasure.
You put the host to work, and he's got lots of editing and stuff to do on this thing.
Good.
So we've had a good conversation so far, Bruce. We're just getting closer to the end of the show, and maybe we should just do a little quick review of all the cool things we've done. We got the music lined up and putting that into our show, and you're born and raised in Ottawa and worked out west for a while and followed a career of academia across the province, and here you are now.
Right.
And wearing a hat of a historian and a commentator on agricultural history, but mostly on agricultural marketing right now and in supply management.
Right.
Life is good.
Life's very good for me. I have to say it's I often say to my wife, I should have switched subjects years ago. I have quite a number of books and articles, and when I was a historian, I wrote on Canadian trade policy. I have books with university presses, which it's quite difficult to get a book with a university press. I just mentioned that as context, but like many, many people do, of course. But when I would do that, I would get maybe, I don't know, two comments about maybe I got this name wrong on page 206 of the book, you know, and you wonder, it's a book published by University of Toronto Press out there, actually on, say, Canadian economic development between, and I have one on this, between 1957 and 1973, which I found actually to be a very, very interesting area to cover and timeline to cover, but you get no reaction to it at all. You know, you spend probably 5 years of your life in archives, writing, goes to the press, they edit it, they tell you what they want changed and various other things. And I think, in a sense, what's the point? Well, there is a point, of course, and it does have some impact, but I often think it's unrequited hopes for a book like that. When I moved into supply management, and sort of which is a topical subject these days, for sure, I've been writing on this for maybe 10 years or so, and you get instant reaction, and you might get 100 or 200 criticisms or people supporting you or reactions on all sorts of fronts. So I've said to my wife, I should have moved into this area, done the history of supply management or the history of agriculture in Canada or Ontario much, much earlier than I did. If I started 25 years ago, it would probably be a little different situation than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very, very interesting. And, I think I intend to continue writing about supply management in particular, it remains under threat. And I think it's an absolutely excellent system in the sectors in which it operates. And part of the reason why I think it's excellent in those sectors, and again, I'm most familiar with dairy and eggs, is because they aren't traded internationally. Only about 7% of dairy is traded internationally and about 3% of eggs. The entire global production is traded internationally. So those commodities that aren't traded internationally, I think, are great. They benefit from supply management, because what that means is 93% in the case of dairy is that product is consumed domestically, and in the case of eggs, it's 97%. So why not have those kinds of systems which even out the peaks and troughs of farmer income to make life more sustainable and resilient for them?
Mm-hmm. I hope you have the chance that as your career unfolds to do some other fun things too, whether it's going back to concerts or maybe building a boat in the basement or something.
Yeah, well, again, my wife would probably say I'd build a boat in the basement that's too big to get up the stairs, so that might happen as well.
I have no doubt we'll see your name and you'll be out in the boat doing your craft for many years yet, and just glad you could have a chance to talk a little bit more about your specialty, which is supply management, that our urban listeners can probably understand and appreciate. That's half the battle, as we were talking, is there's quite a spread between the actual right. practitioners and the people who they have an interest in, urban people, but not necessarily a chance to get to know what's going on.
Right. And I think there is a greater interest now in agriculture, I think, and in particular what's in the food we eat. Mm-hmm. You know, in milk, something like 17%, for example, of American farmers, and they're usually the biggest farmers in the U.S., they might have a 20,000 cow herd that they milk. It's industrial dairies, for sure. They use growth hormone. So, and I actually read on I was in the States a couple of weekends ago, and I read on a milk carton something like, the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has determined that RBST, growth hormone, is not detrimental to one's health. The fact that they have to put that on a milk carton that's sold in a corner store is highly significant to me. Of course, our dairy farmers have consciously made the decision not to use growth hormone. Right. So consumers are much more interested now in what's in their food, and that shows up in their demand for free-range organic, perhaps. Also, just to get to know farmers and what it is that farmers do. I interviewed an egg farmer in British Columbia once, and he was an organic free-range guy, and he said he would go into Safeway in Vancouver. He lived in Abbotsford, and he would go into Safeway in Vancouver and just stand by an egg cooling place, and consumers would come up, and he sold his eggs under his own brand, and they'd come up, and they'd take his eggs, and he'd say, you know, those are my eggs. And as soon as they found out that he was the farmer, he said that they'd spend minutes talking to him, and in fact, eventually, of course, midway through the day, he has to excuse himself because there's almost a lineup of people wanting to talk to him to find out how he farms, what he farms, what's it like being a farmer. So I think there is an intense interest now as well, given the fixation on food, and fresh food in particular, about what farmers do. So I think that all augurs well for the future.
I can speak to that a bit, too. I like to sell some freeze beef on my farm, 8 head a year. So, but I think I should get a check from some beef producers for all the PR I do on behalf of the industry.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see where in the long term, you know, that all those farmers, whether you're organic, whatever you are going to close ranks because it's in each other's best interest to be able to explain or understand what the other guy's doing.
Oh, yeah.
I would think. And you know, supply management's doing that. They have an organic milk pool in dairy.
Yeah.
And there's the same thing in chickens, isn't there, I think?
They don't have, I don't know about chicken, about poultry itself, but in terms of eggs, they do have a designation for free-range organic, but I think it's still a work in progress with egg farmers of Ontario.
So there's lots of opportunity for cooperation.
Yeah.
And that's good to hear.
I think farmers absolutely should cooperate right across.
Excuse me.
If they don't, you know, it's either stick together or sink individually, I think, because it's a tough world out there. You know, and if you look at the cost of equipment, you know, a John Deere tractor might be $700,000. There are issues about feed costs for animals. You know, how neonics, of course, are now big in the news again. And I think the province and the federal government are going to get together. And I sort of think the science is, I was reading something about neonics this morning, you know, and despite the fact that many farmers think that they're very, very useful in terms of growing certain crops, it does seem that the science is now pointing to an adverse effect on bees and bumblebees in particular early in the spring. So those are all issues, you know, that are just waiting to be dealt with, I think. And, yeah, and the farmer probably will be disadvantaged. And I think what you really have to do as farmers is educate the consumer, because consumers sometimes have funny ideas about what it is to be a farmer and how it is you grow these things. So I think it's really, really important that consumers get to know exactly what it is that happens on a farm, mm-hmm, so as not to misconstrue best attempts with somehow something that's disadvantageous for the countryside or, you know, the product that they're producing.
And interested consumers can go to the respective websites for the various commodities in Ontario, and you can make an effort to go to things like, I think Breakfast on the Farm is coming up here this year, which is an annual event. I think they're going to a sheep farm. Why do I think that this year? And you can go to the farmer's market, and if you want to go yak to some guy growing stuff there, you can probably do that.
Yep. No, that's true. St. Jacobs is a destination now. We live in Elmira, just pretty close to St. Jacobs, and we go every once in a while. But to fight the traffic there on a Saturday morning is just unbelievable. So mm-hmm, that's really, really heartening to see, I think. And it's really good. And those people talk to those farmers, and then lots of farmers are selling their stuff there. So
yeah,
I think it's a great development.
And you're working at the university, and so the students come through on a regular 3-term-a-year basis, I think it is up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so one crew goes up. What are you teaching in history when you're up there? What is your topic?
I taught a course in global governance this year, which is with the Belsilli School of International Affairs.
Very
interesting. The students are first rate, I have to say, and very, very, they certainly press you when you say anything. And of course, now, a difference from when I was a student, if you say anything that's at all controversial, they're on their computers instantly checking to see whether or not you're, at least Google thinks you're right or not. So they certainly keep you on your toes.
And how many is in your little flock of students this year? Shall I call them a flock? I'm sure I'm insulted.
Right. They might not like that. I don't know. I had 17 this year, and it's generally around 17. Mm-hmm. So it's... And they're master's level students, so it's, again, they're sort of one step up from undergraduate, for sure. So, and they're remarkable, I think. They're from all over the country, sometimes from other parts of the world, too, which is, and they bring lots of interesting talents to bear on the subject. And global governance is an interesting subject. Of course, agriculture is covered by certain global governance agreements and arrangements, and so we certainly talked about those too. And, you know, coming out of Geneva or out of Rome or in Food and Agriculture Organization or out of Brussels, so it's a very, very interesting subject.
Yeah, no, that sounds like it's, you have the all in proper doses. It's quite an interesting thing you're doing.
Yeah, no, and being able to do research and also teach students and being in administration there. Good doses of each one, so I'm very, very happy with how things are evolving as I move closer to retirement, I guess.
Yeah, I'm glad you come in today and talk. We have this great list of songs, and we've been putting them into our discussion here all afternoon. And so is there anything that comes to mind we've covered so much stuff, Bruce, I don't know where to start. Anything come to mind that you'd like to bring up again in the light of our conversation? You know how things come up in conversation.
Right.
We agree that people should get out and visit, and they should check out information, and they should have a good balanced view on whatever the issue is being presented.
Right.
But enjoy life, and food's good.
Food's great.
Food's safe.
Yep. Food's great. Yeah.
Boy, are you a cook by any chance or a gardener?
No. My wife and I garden, but we're not. We grow some herbs and hot peppers, but that's it, in pots only in downtown Elmira where we live. So it's, we can smell the manure. You know, they spread it on the field. Certainly this time of year, a little bit drier, I think, would have been a little bit better.
Right. Yeah.
But we can smell that when we sit out in the backyard. I actually like the smell. I also have a bike route that I ride. It's about 50 Ks around Elmira, sort of a big... So I go out through the back 40, up Arthur Street, and then wind my way through, you know, 8th Line. And that's it. Anyway,
well,
in the rural areas.
That's great.
Yeah, it's a great...
And they got good bike lanes along there for you?
No, but there are
few
cars
there
for the most part, although it is busier now than it was when it started 10 years ago. But yes. I tell her I come back, I like the smell of manure spread on fields, and she thinks I'm a little nutty. So, but I still, and I like sitting in the backyard, and as I say, in the winds from the right quarter, you can know that farmers are spreading manure on their fields. Yeah. Elmira is sort of in the middle of a big dairy area, so it's...
Well, it's pretty unique in the Marley region. In fact, we do have one of the highest, farms that do have multiple sources of income, beef, dairy, livestock, and crops.
Right.
Traditionally in Ontario, it's one or the other. You specialize, but by the magic of geography and right. the aptitude of people and the capability of the soil, we have soils and land here that is producing a lot of stuff every acre.
Right.
Whether it's livestock or crop.
Right.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that provincial policy about green belts is really, really important in the preservation of that too. And I think Waterloo region, or mm-hmm. it's a regional issue, or if it's a municipal one. Whoever it is has developed the density, increasing density requirements for housing is really, really spot on. And I always think when I ride my bike down Benjamin Road, it sort of separates. On one side, it's fields of corn or soybeans, depending. On the other, it's housing. And I think probably in no other city would you see that kind of development, yeah. where instead houses would have spread out across this absolutely wonderful agricultural land. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's really, really important that we have an eye out for that.
It's an amazing feat of planning to have the concept of a fixed edge and then actually not have it implied that it's going to happen. So traditionally, a subdivision happens and there's always these blank lots where, oh, yeah, they're going to expand. Yeah. So you build the idea of expectation in there that it's going to get bigger.
Right.
It's quite a turn of the ship to just say, okay, it ends here.
Yeah, I think, and yeah. I'm sure a lot of people weren't happy with that, and I know the Ontario government's taken some heat over it too, but I think it's absolutely the right policy looking down the road. Again, when I was an undergraduate in the early 1970s, one of the things we talked a lot about was the loss of farmland in southern Ontario, and we've come a huge way, of course, in terms of the loss of farmland from the 1970s to where we are now. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we can afford to lose any more farmland, certainly not at the rate we had lost it before.
Well, once it's gone, it's gone. That's the trouble.
Yeah, you can't. The hard part. Even if you tear up the asphalt, it's not going to be the same kind of stuff it was before.
You're not going to recreate that environment at all, that's for sure.
I think it's very, very important.
And our last song that you've brought along is by Tom Paxton, is Buy a Gun for Your Son. My goodness.
Right. Also, an ironic title, of course, Tom Paxton being certainly a left-wing singer from, again, back in the 60s and into the 70s. And he has a number of, I think, great, great songs about protest songs primarily. And that's Buy a Gun for Your Son is all about why you really shouldn't buy a gun for your son. But anyway, he really spins a good yarn with that one, I think.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, rebels, yanks, and commies, buy yourself some real red-blooded fun. If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. Buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir. Pound that kid into submission till he's mastered nuclear fission, buy him plastic warheads by the score. Once he's got the taste of blood, he's gonna sneak up on his buddies, starting his own thermonuclear war. Oh, buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir. Buy him khakis and fatigues and sign him up in little leagues and give him calisthenics as a rule. Once you've banished fear and dread, then pat his seven-year-old head and send him off to military school. Oh, buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir. Once he's grown to be a man, he might get tired of blasting granny, then you'll see a crisis coming on. Don't get worried, don't get nervous. Send that kid into service. Let him rise into the Pentagon. At the Pentagon, he'll rise the president. He will advise, his reputation growing all the while. With your picture on the wall, he'll get that long-awaited call and press the firing buttons with a smile. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir.
I'm Ken Sealing, I'm the regional chair, and you're listening to Community Radio, CKMS, Radio Waterloo. It's live streaming on the FM band 102.7 or on Rogers Digital Network, it's 946, or on the internet at soundfilm.ca. Happy to support community radio broadcasts to promote local news and entertainment through spoken word music. You're listening to the Agriculture Show. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents farm producers in the region of Waterloo. Their goal, and we're happy to work with them, is to promote farm community in support of innovation, hard work, and compassion. It's emblematic of the region of Waterloo. We really encourage the WFA to work together to bring the policy needs of farmers together with the policy needs of society and working together, making this a better region.
So all good stuff, Bruce, but we're covering all kinds of stuff. We're at almost the end of our show. I have my one last favorite question for you, and I ask all my guests. And says,
okay.
What are you doing in the next 2 hours? 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, and 2 years. What are you doing the next 2 hours?
I'll be going back to work. I think I have a couple of things I have to finish up there. Then after that, I'll be going home. With any luck, it'll be warm enough. The one sunny day of however many we've experienced where my wife and I will sit out in the backyard, maybe have a glass of wine or something like that as well.
Very nice.
And then in the next couple of weeks, I'm actually going to Norway on a research trip.
2 days. Let's go. Let's do the whole work.
So oh, 2 days.
Get our money's worth.
What is 2 days? Next Friday. Yeah, it's Wednesday today.
Right.
Next Friday, or this coming Friday. Actually, we're going to, in the evening, we're going to St. Catharines to be with friends who we're meeting up with other friends as well from Thunder Bay. And we'll go to dinner, which will be nice, I think. We're seeing six if you include us from Thunder Bay. It's like a gathering of some kind.
Yeah, it'd be a good crowd.
Yeah, it'll be fun for sure. We've known them all for many, many years.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks from now, we'll be in Norway where I'm going as a visiting professor to the Center of Rural Research, Bygdeforskning in Norwegian. And we're working on a book project as well with them. So that's great. One of the perks of the job for sure.
And in 2 months, that'll put us into what the heck? That'll be in May, June, July, summer, middle of summer.
I'll be back at work. In administration, you don't get any time off ever. So anyway, I wouldn't say burning the midnight oil, but I'll certainly be at work over the course of days in June and July and August.
Of course, in the midst of all this, you'll get various requests for little radio show stuff and other papers you got to put together for your various people you're adding input to. So
That's all fun. So yes. Yeah, and my postdoc and I will continue on with writing the book over the summer as well. So as I say, she's happy to do that. I think
that'd be fun to hear about that book. It'll be out in 2 years when we can maybe come back and we can talk about it.
Actually, that was, you say 2 hours, 2 days, two weeks, 2 months, and, 2 years, we'll have the book.
Yeah, excellent.
Right.
Well, I hope it'd be so delightful to have a book that you co-authored with your history background. It does add an extra little bit to any kind of a study that.
Yeah, well, it is great fun to do it. As I say, looking at archival documents is like reading other people's mail. And I know that some of the people who actually wrote the documents, you know, from the 60s or the 70s, never in a million years thought somebody would be reading this in a completely different context. So I think otherwise they might have been a bit more careful.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's great stuff.
Sounds like you're anticipating that it'll be really super stuff. With that, we've done well here, Mr. Muirhead. We are in an hour of material. We're going to put some music in, and hopefully this podcast is soon.
Great. And well, thanks a lot, Jeff.
I just want to thank you so much for coming.
Oh, well, thank you. It's great to spend an hour. You know, when I start talking about this at home, my wife often says, stop talking about that. You know, we got other things. But if you're here and you want to hear about it, I'm so happy to oblige. So thanks very much for inviting me, and it's been great, a great joy for me.
Thanks very much for saying that, Bruce. And to our dear listeners, thanks again for listening in. We'll be back in 6 days and 22 hours with Small Bit Agriculture. It's been episode number 190 of the Agriculture Show, and we'll see you in a week. Bye for now. And if you eat this week, make a farmer. So long.